The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. Well, I can hardly believe it is December already. And I spent this past weekend putting up Christmas lights, which I feel like I'm behind, actually, because I think because of the semi-lockdown we're in here, people are getting to put their trees and their lights up much earlier.
Well, but, yeah, I've had mine up for like 2 weeks, Peter. But normally, this time of year, I don't. But, yeah. You know, there's not a lot going on the weekend, so you might as well
That's
decorate.
Right. And then the weather's been mild. But Christmas is a season, well, we'll see what it's like. I mean, what state we'll be in. We typically have lots of family over and meals and things and, you know, all the hard work that we did shedding pounds over the course of the year gives way to eating a lot more with friends and family. And, well, you know, speaking about carbs, right, which are in food, we're going to talk today about how to lower carbs, but not necessarily food carbs. We're going to talk about lowering carbs in hydrocarbons, right?
That's right. So, you know, this year it may be easier to stay on your diet because you're not going to have so many friends and family over. So maybe that's one positive. But we're going to talk about the need to get lower carbon in terms of the amount of energy we use and amount of CO2 emissions associated with that energy. And we want to talk today about a new policy called the Clean Fuel Standard. We've mentioned it quite a few times on the podcast, but we thought it would be worth 101, an explanation of how these policies work. And they are used already in many other areas. We don't know the details of the Canadian policy. The draft is going to come out probably this month. But we just want to talk in general about how these policies work.
Well, it's important to talk about this and ramp up because the material behind this policy and the concepts behind it are actually quite dense and technical. And we're going to try and do a one-on-one on this podcast. But I think it's going to take several podcasts to really dig into this. And we have to start now because it is going to come to the fore in Canadian energy policy in the first quarter of next year. And I think anybody who has a stake in energy needs to pay attention to what this means. But it's not as if Canada's the first to do this. I mean, it's been around in jurisdictions in the United States for sure.
Yeah, it's been around 10 years in California, Europe, BC, and also in Oregon, so even a Canadian province. What is a little different is the Canadian plan is going to regulate for liquid fuels like gasoline and diesel, but also gas and coal, where other jurisdictions, it's all liquid fuels. So that's the one difference. But the concept's been around for a long time, and we can look at some examples from some of those other jurisdictions.
Yeah. So the goal is to reduce the amount of carbon in a hydrocarbon fuel like gasoline or diesel or natural gas, to reduce that carbon content.
Yes, from the well to the wheel. Right. So we've talked about this concept or well to combustion. So from, you know, all the emissions associated with producing, distributing, and finally combusting it, you need to reduce the emissions in that whole full cycle. And usually it's in the range of 10% over a 10-year period. So it doesn't all happen the first year. There's usually plans that ramp up to 10% over the course of 10 years.
I think it will be important to look at those segments, the upstream, the midstream, and the downstream combustion of the fuels. The vast majority of the emissions are in the combustion.
Yes, about 80% are in the combustion for hydrocarbons. Yeah.
And then upstream, obviously 20%, depending upon where the oil or the gas comes from, how it's processed, and how it's distributed. So in terms of reducing the size of the full pie or pizza. Actually, why don't we use that food metaphor as we go into the podcast? So in terms of reducing the size of the pie by 10%, there's a number of ways you can do it.
That's right. And actually, I would actually say, and I'm going to use this example from Canada West Foundation. They just recently put out a paper, which we'll put a link to in the show notes. They talked about the pizza story. And really what you're trying to do is to reduce the calories associated with the pizza. So I wouldn't say you're changing the size, but imagine, you know, you have high fat cheese, you're going to go to low fat cheese. So your car is going to consume a certain amount of fuel, but it's like you've now got the lower carbon version of that fuel.
Right.
And so that's what these policies aim to do is make your diet more healthy.
Right.
For the petroleum fuel, it's how do we reduce the greenhouse gas emissions associated with it, making it a healthier fuel. And how you do that is there's three different ways you can do it. And generally, these policies allow varying amounts of each of these ways. So one is one we talked a lot about last week, which is you put in a lower carbon liquid fuel, like a biofuel. So you blend that in, and by doing that, you know, if you take very low carbon fuel, you blend it in with a higher carbon fuel, the average is reduced, and you can actually
dilute
it and get a lower carbon overall
fuel. I've sort of been taking to calling that a carbon diluent, right? It's a little bit like a blood thinner. So what is the magnitude of emissions reduction you can get by doing that, by blending?
Well, it really depends on the ethanol. And I think, you know, Doug, our guest last week, talked about these biofuels are really being differentiated by the amount of carbon they have, and the lower carbon, the more value. But to give you an example, if your gasoline was about 90 grams of CO2 per megajoule, which is about the average, then if you had a biofuel like ethanol that was 30 grams of CO2 per megajoule, if you blended 15% ethanol with 85% gasoline, you would achieve about a 10% drop. Your combined carbon would now be about 81 instead of the 90 that you started with.
So, I mean, that's nothing new. I mean, we've had what they call E85 for decades. I mean, the blended ethanol. It's just that now it's not a choice in terms of the consumer pulling up to the pump and choosing between E85 or regular gasoline. It's going to be blended for you up at the refinery. It's going to go through the pipes, and everybody's going to have an E85 or equivalent.
Exactly. Today, Doug talked about the fact that about 6% of our gasoline has ethanol in it. Mm-hmm. And by 2030, you would see 15% if people chose this as the only mechanism to meet this goal. This isn't the only way to do it. So I don't know that we're going to see that much ethanol being used in Canada.
Right. Okay. So this is like diluting the cheese with lower carb cheese, lower fat cheese.
Lower fat cheese. Yeah, it's like you're sprinkling half your pizza with the low fat. Doesn't taste as good, but it's healthier.
Right. Okay. So method number two is the upstream. So the extraction, the production and distribution, processing, all that stuff where 20% of the emissions are generated.
Yes, that's right. So there's lots of opportunities to reduce the upstream emissions.
So upstream is 20% of the emissions.
Well, upstream and refining.
And refining. Okay. Upstream and refining before you combust is 20% of the emissions. So let's just say the upstream producers / refiners reduce by 10%. That's 10% of 20, which is 2% of the whole, right?
Yeah, exactly. So you can't make it just by doing that.
Right. But if you reduce 10% on the back end through, or 15% through E85, it's a much more meaningful drop because that's where the bulk of the emissions are.
That's true, although you still could do it 100% with the upstream. For example, 20% of your emissions does come from that. If you could half them, there, you got your 10%.
You got your 10%.
Yeah. I think you will see a fair amount of reductions come from the upstream because we have a large oil and gas industry in Canada, and there's lots of opportunity for GHG emission reductions.
Right, and actually the credit system, which I think we should come to in a few minutes, gives incentives for those upstream producers to reduce as much as possible. And could be potentially quite lucrative.
Exactly. So today, you know, a producer in oil and gas is required by law to reduce a certain amount of their methane. This would give them some motivation to get rid of all their methane because they could generate revenue by selling these credits, which would pay for the reduction, but probably provide some profit as
And say if they had the ability, an upstream producer, to reduce all of their emissions, effectively go to the net zero state, then they would actually be rewarded and contribute dramatically to the overall reduction across the full life cycle.
Exactly. So if they did that, they could go sell credits.
Right.
By the way, we didn't talk about who's responsible for this role. The person that's responsible is the fuel distributor. So it would be companies like Petro-Canada, Parkland, Fast Gas. So you would go sell them these credits. So instead of blending in the biofuels, they could say, no, I purchased credits that represent that much savings in GHG emissions. So therefore, I'm complying that way.
Right.
And there's many opportunities, obviously, in oil and gas. You know, you could do things like reduce the burning of hydrocarbons, instead use low carbon electricity. You get credits for things like that. Carbon capture and storage. Things like starting to use hydrogen instead of natural gas for energy. And realistically, none of these things are really going to make sense, in my view, unless we have a policy like this, because the producer needs some sort of economic incentive to reduce their emissions, and this provides that.
Right. I want to go back to the word that you use, the distributor, because understanding where the focal point of all of this is really important. So we have the well, the oil well. The oil is extracted. produced out, put into a facility, processed, and then transported through pipe or by truck or however to the refinery. The refinery takes the oil, refines it into petroleum product like gasoline or diesel, and then it's ready to be distributed at that point. At that point, the distributor also can blend in biofuels or other carbon diluents, and then it goes off to the gas station, and the consumer then fills up his or her tank and puts it in there.
Exactly. And it's that distributor that then distributes it out to the retail system that's responsible for complying. Mm-hmm. And they have these different modes. You know, it could be blending in the diluent, or it could be buying some credits from others.
Okay. But I think we should keep in mind that node of distribution, because it's so important in terms of understanding how the credit system works. But before we go back to that, let's go to option number three, which is to effectively not use hydrocarbon fuels at all.
That's right. You can use other alternatives for transportation.
Right.
Like you do, Peter.
Like an electric vehicle.
You could have an electric vehicle, or you could start to have hydrogen vehicles like the mayors from Edmonton and Sturgeon County told us about, right? Mm-hmm. You could use hydrogen to turn the wheels.
Right. Assuming the hydrogen doesn't come from hydrocarbons, but comes from other sources.
Yes, if it's blue hydrogen.
Basically, this is the metaphor for not eating pizza at all and eating something else that has zero carbs.
Yes, I guess that's right. Zero carb pizza. When they invent that, I'm going to be first in line.
Okay.
That's like Diet Coke. That's the Diet Coke version.
Yeah.
Of another analog. So, you know, what happens here is it really depends on the policy and the jurisdiction. And we don't know how it's going to exactly work out in Canada. But in general, the people that generate credits are the ones that have those charging stations, because they can keep track of how much electricity was put into the car. And then depending on location, they can figure out how much carbon improvement there was. And we talked about that a few podcasts ago. Depending on which electricity you're using, you know, the electric car has varying benefits in terms of the GHG emissions. And those generally, in some of the policies, those charging stations are supposed to give some rebate back to the EV owners as a way to incent more EV ownership, because it reduces the total cost of ownership to you. So it doesn't generally flow right back to the consumer initially, but that's the idea.
Okay. So the Clean Fuel Standard offers three options in summary. Number one, blending in low carbon hydrocarbons, such as biofuels, to reduce the back end combustion. Number two, reducing the amount of emissions in the production of the hydrocarbons and refining of the hydrocarbons. And number three, get off hydrocarbons altogether with zero carbon energy sources.
Right. And even if it's not zero carbon today,
track what it is and
keep track of the emissions benefit.
Okay. So now that we have an understanding of what this tries to do, let's talk about the credit system and the incentives to do it.
Right. Well, I think the way to do that maybe would be to talk a little bit about California, where there's been an established market for a while. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about the credits and also some of the projects that have been developed because of this credit market. And to me, this is the exciting part of the policy. There are concerns about this policy in Canada, and there's lots of details for sure. But the exciting part is what we're seeing in California from the perspective of investment that's occurring because of it. Mm-hmm. So we'll talk about the credit market first. So generally, something that makes this very different than like a carbon tax, and we'll talk about the difference here in a bit, but is that these credits are generally much higher value. So when California started, they were generally around $100 a ton. But recently, in the last several years, as the compliance has tightened and there's been more requirement for credits, we've actually seen the credits trade closer to $200 a ton. Mm-hmm. So they are very high-priced credits. So go back to that story of the oil and gas producer. The oil and gas producer can get a credit that's quite high-valued for reducing their GHG emissions under these types
two.
Of policies.
Under option two. But before we get to that, let's talk about the penalty side of this. Let's examine the incentives to, let's just say, dilute the hydrocarbon. Because if you don't dilute, then you have to pay at the margin that 10% that you are obliged in future to reduce, $200 a ton on that 10%.
Right. So in California, they have set a maximum price at $200 a ton. Mm. So if you as a distributor say, I don't want to buy biofuels, I can't find enough credits.
Right.
You can go to the regulator and just pay them the equivalent of $200 a ton for the emissions you should have removed. Mm-hmm. So to put that in perspective, I will just kind of give you an example on gasoline. if you had to pay $200 a ton to reduce your emissions about 12%, that would be the equivalent of an additional 7 cents per liter that the distributor would have to pay the government and probably pass that on to the consumer as well.
Right.
That's how it would work if you chose not to. So economically, if you can do anything cheaper than that, than $200 mm-hmm. a ton, you would do that
right.
generally.
Right. But it's on the margin. And I think this is where people get tripped up because they think that the $200 a ton is on the entire, I'll call it the pizza, but it's not. It's on the 10% that's the really high calorie side of it, right?
That's right. So you're only paying that very high carbon price on a very narrow piece of the pizza.
Right.
So to give you an example, a carbon tax is very different. A carbon tax you pay, in the case of Canada in a couple of years, $50 a ton, but on the 80% of all the well-to-wheel emissions. So we talked about it before, 80% of all the emissions come from combustion. And on a carbon tax, the consumer pays for every
right.
combustion emission. So that, for example, the same gasoline example, at $50 mm-hmm. a ton in Canada, that would be the equivalent of about 12 cents a liter of extra cost.
Yeah. Well, let's just bring it back to that food metaphor, because it's one that I find very effective and actually one that I used extensively in my second book, The End of Energy Obesity, which by itself, the title implies a food metaphor. So if the average person, and it depends if you're male and female and your physical makeup, say consumes 2,500 calories a day, right? The carbon tax equivalent, the carb tax, should you choose to continue to eat 2,500 calories per day, would be on the entire 2,500.
Exactly.
But under the clean fuel standard, what the policy is trying to do is to get you to consume 250 calories less, 10% less, right? So you consume 2,250 calories. And that the 250 that they're trying to get you to stop eating is subject to the $200 per ton, or in this case, per calorie. Does that make sense?
That's right. So let's come back to the California example. So their credits are much higher priced. They're very different than a carbon mm-hmm. tax. And one last thing I want to say, because, you know, we do have a lot of people concerned about this policy. They call it a double tax because, mm-hmm. you know, we already have a carbon tax in Canada, and now you're putting additional cost on the consumer with this new policy. It's not as transparent because we're not exactly sure how much it will cost. It depends which compliance mechanisms are mm-hmm. available, but it is a second cost that comes on
but
to
only
the price
on
of
the
gasoline.
Margin. It's not only on the margin.
It only is on the margin.
Yeah.
And I would say they're very different. And let's bring back that food story. Like, what you're trying to do is with carbon tax is get people to use less, right? Like you're
right.
basically saying, I'm going to tax all of it and, you know, I'm trying to get you to use less gasoline. When it comes to the low carbon fuel standard, it's not really an incentive to use less. It's basically just saying we want to make your food more healthy. So if all we did is make the food more healthy, but we all ate the same amount, or maybe we even ate more. Sometimes that happens when you go on a diet. You eat healthier, so you feel like you can eat more.
Yes.
And what they've found actually in California is that these policies haven't generated the reductions in overall emissions that they expected because people have generally chosen to buy bigger vehicles and consume more fuel. And you can see that. We've talked about this chart many times, but that picture of the amount of truck sales in the United States from 2001 to 2013, about half of all vehicles sold were trucks and larger vehicles. And today, it's closer to 80%. And that's because the low price of gasoline has motivated people to get larger vehicles. So,
mm-hmm.
so you kind of need both policies. You need
do.
One to get people to reduce the amount of fuel they use. And this one is to create it to be lower carbon, the fuel that they do use.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a big issue in terms of even energy efficiency. You make things more efficient and people just, they call it actually eat their efficiencies, continuing in the food metaphor. I mean, it's just like, okay, you make electric light bulbs six times more efficient because they're LED. And so you string up seven times as many lights. So what have you really gained? It's a big problem. And so actually one policy on its own typically is insufficient to give you the optimum solutions, but that's the subject for a whole other podcast.
Well, and I mean, if the goal is to reduce emissions to net zero by 2050, mm-hmm. It is going to cost more money. In this case, we'll come back to this gasoline example. Mm-hmm. You have 12 cents a liter associated
right.
with carbon tax,
right.
and then you have $200 a ton on just about 10% of your emissions, which adds another 7 cents. But they do different things. And on their own, neither of them are really going to result in big reductions.
Right.
I mean, I honestly think the carbon tax has to go up quite a bit to get people to use less fuel as well, right? Because I don't think 12 cents a liter is necessarily changing people's... People are not choosing to drive less or buy smaller vehicles.
No.
We're not seeing that in the data yet.
No, not at all.
I think you're probably going to need a higher carbon tax to get that overall consumption of fuel down as well.
Right. So if we get back to now the upstream side, this option to the producer, the oil and gas producer, reduces the emissions off of some baseline, the mechanics of which we don't really fully know yet in terms of how that's all going to work. In terms of, okay, you measure your emissions today, and let's say the producer then, out of 100 units of emissions, cuts five for the sake of argument. By cutting five, they get credits for cutting five off of the baseline, and those credits can then be sold downstream to the blender.
Exactly. And they can say, instead of blending in biofuels, I'm going to buy these credits, which represent the same amount of carbon improvement to my fuel.
Right. And so if the producer can reduce their emissions for, say, $5 to, say, $15, let's call it $10 a unit, and then can sell downstream for much higher than that, then there's huge incentive for the producers to really reduce their emissions.
Right. And I wanted to talk about California because there are some pretty exciting stories there, because, you know, this type of policy, not only does it reduce the emissions of the fuel, but it can create new investment in reduction opportunities that wouldn't exist otherwise. So, for example, starting in January of 2019, California said that they will allow carbon capture storage projects that are associated with California to generate credits. And this is a key driver for a very big project that's going on in Texas right now, where Occidental is going to capture CO2 from the air using Canadian technology, actually, Carbon Engineering's technology. We had David Keith on our podcast.
Yeah.
And they are going to sequester that in the oil and gas reservoirs that they have. And this is a fairly expensive technology. Many people say it needs about $200 a ton to make it work. But because the California Low Carbon Fuel Standard is currently trading at about $200 a ton, these types of investments can make sense. And they're going to be raising billions of dollars and investing that capital in projects because of this policy, and they're going to reduce emissions as well.
Right. So it creates the financial incentives for both producers to reduce their emissions.
Yeah, it takes the well to wheel. It's taking more of those upstream emissions out. And so the distributor can then use that as their credit to comply. Another example, we talked about it on the podcast last week with Doug from Canadian Advanced Biofuels. He told us about the opportunity for renewable diesel, that there were new processes where you could co-process biofuels in the refinery. And these biofuels had the advantage that they were more drop-in. They didn't have as many limitations in terms of how much a car could accept. Interestingly enough, in California right now, there are two refiners, big refineries, Phillips 66 in San Francisco and Marathon Martinez. These are, you know, the case of Marathon Martinez, 160,000 barrel a day refinery. Phillips 66 is an 88,000 barrel a day refinery. They are completely converting to biofuels. And a lot of this being motivated by the Clean Fuel Standard, because they can now generate all these credits by making biofuels and biodiesel instead of petroleum. And so that's creating a bunch of investment in California, new jobs, new capital expenditure in order to support this policy. So someone is paying, like in the case of the consumer, the one I said, there's about 7 cents per liter extra costs associated with this. Mm-hmm. But then that money is flowing towards capital investments in the economy and creating jobs and things like that. So there are benefits too.
Yeah, this is why I was sort of alluding when we talked with Doug last week that there's sort of going to be a biofuels renaissance. I mean, he was talking about doubling or more the biofuels output here in Canada. So, you know, we'll see what that results in terms of strategic issues and other issues. And sort of getting right down to the mechanics of this thing, I think it all makes good sense in theory. We have established market tests that it seems to work in places like California. But it's going to really be predicated here on also being able to measure baselines of emissions, and even in the biofuel, measure all sorts of things. Because if you can't measure, how can you calculate credits? How can you get this whole thing working and get the market working?
Mm-hmm.
So where are we at then in terms of the policy?
Well, the policy is expected to come out in December, so that will be the draft legislation. Yes, it is December. Wow. So by the end of December, we should see the draft legislation. And at that point, we'll have a lot more details associated with what the policy may look like in Canada. Now, that first draft is only for the liquids fuels. So there's a three-phased approach here. There's a liquids fuels, so that will affect gasoline and diesel in Canada. And we're going to get the draft legislation. There's an opportunity to provide feedback on that draft, and then there'll be final legislation out later this year with the idea that this comes into effect in 2022. This later on in 2021, we are going to get a little bit more details for the natural gas. They're calling it the gaseous fuels and the pet coke. So any kind of coal that's used in Canada will also apply. And the idea is that those rules would come in force in 2023. So we're not going to get a lot of details on those right away. We're just going to learn about the liquid fuels. But of course, that's very consequential. That's a big part of the fuels used in Canada.
Notwithstanding the pandemic, I felt like 2020 went like a blink of an eye. 2021, 2022 is not very far away. And this is just draft legislation. There has to be to-ing and fro-ing to finalize it, enact it. And then the industry has to sort of tool up, I'll call it, to be able to do all the accounting and make all of this work. It seems like a fairly aggressive timeline.
Well, you know, I think that there are have been groups working for a long time. Doug, last week, talked about the fact there are these working groups that have been working on this since 2016. But this is the first time it sort of sees the light of day and becomes a public document. And I think there's a lot of broader stakeholders that are going to be very interested in it. There's only about 75 days to comment on the draft. So there is a limited time frame associated with that. But I do think everyone should have a look at it. It's a pretty consequential policy.
And you know what? What I've noted is that, okay, you and I live and breathe this stuff, read the documents and the reports, get up to speed on it. But if you're not really looking at this thing in great detail, there's a lot to digest. And I think there's a lot of education that needs to be done in terms of what this all means, how it's all going to work. Where do you think that's at? In terms of Canada, in terms of dealing with the various industry segments, because this is not just an oil and gas thing. This is going to permeate across the economy.
Yeah, I think there's definitely lots to be done. And I've talked to a lot of people about this policy. I think one of the big areas of concern is the gaseous policy. It has the potential to increase the prices of natural gas. And that has an impact on a lot of industrial manufacturers in Canada, no matter if you're creating oil and gas or you're manufacturing steel or different things that petrochemicals that use a lot of natural gas. So there's concerns around that. It is important that we think about that. Those are trade exposed industries where if their costs go up substantially, it may make it harder for them to compete on the global stage. And so I think a lot of thought has to go into that. There are concerns around duplication. There's a lot of policies in Canada already for greenhouse gas emissions reductions and at the provincial level and the federal level. So I definitely think this needs to be designed well. And it needs to consider all these different concerns. But I would come back to the fact that I do think in general, these policies are smart policies. They can generate high-priced credits at the margin, so they don't cost the consumer as much as a carbon tax. And then those credits can be used to reduce emissions, and that results in new investment in Canada, hopefully. Like, I believe that this type of policy could enable us to have a blue or green hydrogen economy and allow us to do a lot more CCS and become leaders in the CCS and you know, move our economy into that net zero. So there's positives here, but it does have to be designed right. And I know a lot of people will be looking very closely at this draft and trying to understand what it means for their business and raising those concerns with the federal government. There is an opportunity to do that through this process.
Yeah, just my personal observation that 75 days is not a heck of a lot of time for something that is actually quite complex, comprehensive. And I agree with you. I think the other part of it is a streamlining of policy so that we don't have policy interfering with policy to reduce the impact of one or the other. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just what they call pancaking of policies.
Well, so we'll give you an update in the new year on the draft, and we're going to talk more about the specific details of the drafts and some of the concerns. So tune in the new year for more information on the Canadian Clean Fuel Standard.
Certainly will not be the last time we talk about it.
Great. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.